Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host...
Miguel. I'm just the co-host this time.
Yeah, well, I considered throwing in afterwards, you're my co-DM and everything, but you know what? Whatever, you get it. This is the show where we compare and contrast the campaigns of the past. That's right, it's Compare and Campaign. I and Miguel, we run our share of RPGs throughout the past, and so we talk about the times we ran those RPGs and try to glean some insights on how we can change or inspire how we run RPGs in the future. It is the 13th of July, 2022, and it is episode 115. Took me a minute there. Miguel.
Tom.
Anything? Well, I just heard you say before the episode, this is kind of a, like, we keep talking about you were barreling towards the end of your campaign, and here we are at the precipice, it seems.
That's right. This is the penultimate session, and you were a bit surprised to hear that it was a shorter session, considering how close to the end this campaign is, and rather than, like, I'm not going to bury the lead, the reason was one of my players, Cater, sort of at the last minute, wasn't able to make it. He got called into work, and so I found out, like, the day before we were going to run this one, that he wasn't going to be there, and so I had to pivot a bit, I had to change things up, but it still wound up as a really fun little session. And his absence worked into the plot quite well. But all that to say, next time, the verse is coming to an end. We're reaching the end of the verse.
Man, that's sounds, you know, I was going to say sounds auspicious, but I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I feel like I read the definition of that word recently and it wasn't what I thought it was. So,
it's like prodigal. Everybody misuses prodigal.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it's just one of those weird words. Yeah, prodigal's definitely... I think it's because prodigal, people think prodigy, and it's like basically the opposite, right?
Well, everybody thinks of the prodigal son returns, right? They think of that phrase.
The only thing he was a prodigy.
Maybe they think of it as a prodigy, or maybe they think of it just as someone coming back after a long journey.
The
only thing they don't think of is someone who's really bad with money.
Yeah, the only thing prodigal son was a prodigy at was, you know, interacting with sex workers and spending all his money away. You know, it's very specific, the crimes that he commits. He drinks a bunch, he sleeps with women of ill repute, etc. Classic Bible story. And then they kill the fatted calf for him. Can you believe that?
Doesn't seem worth it.
I love that I'm giving hot takes on this fucking...
on the Bible.
Old-ass parable.
And hey, is there a Bible RPG?
What the fuck? Oh man, there's gotta be. Man, there's I mean,
there's gotta be like Christian D&D, right?
Well, we've seen that, like, there's RPGs of everything. Like, you found a whole collection of, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger based RPGs. So, like, yeah, there's definitely a biblical RPG. That black metal guy that murdered the dude, Burzum, that piece of shit, he made, like, a white supremacist RPG. I think it's
Wait, what was the game? Hole? No. Fatal? Isn't that just Fatal?
Fatal. Yeah, I mean, I guess. It's just, like... you know, the thing with Burzum's game is that he was active... like, it's basically, like, a very... like traditional kind of meat and potatoes kind of Lord of the Rings inspired vaguely Nordic fantasy world, but then also with, like, overtones of, like, ethnic persecution. I don't know, man. He's got his whole agenda. I mean, he did kill a guy.
Yes, true enough. I did a quick Google search, and it looks like in 2017, someone tried to kickstart a biblical RPG called The Road to Bethlehem. They did not reach their goal, so it
that
did not materialize.
That is astonishing, considering the RPGs that do reach their goal on Kickstarter.
Yeah. And I'm going to read this quick little blurb, and then we can move on, because, you know, I asked the question. I got to provide the answer.
I don't necessarily want to. Maybe I want to talk about biblical RPG ideas for another 15 minutes.
Tom, do not be afraid. I am the Archangel Raphael, and I come to you with an invitation. Many have come to Bethlehem to pay homage to the child and rejoice in his arrival. Now, you too have that chance. I've just opened the gates of Tau, your portal through time and space. The journey will be unlike any that you've ever known. It will be difficult, full of surprises and dangers. Always remember that the gate was opened under one condition. Throughout your journey, you may never use violence against others. I will always watch over you, and if your lives are ever threatened, I will save you and restore you to the time and place whence you set out. Of course, if that happens, you'll have to begin your journey again. During the journey, you will have many opportunities to challenge yourself. Each challenge will be real. You will feel exhaustion, joy, perhaps pain, or maybe even fear. And that is exactly how it is supposed to be. You will learn about yourselves while preparing to meet him. What will the journey mean for you? For some, it will be merely a game, while for others, a moving experience. This game is completely immersing body, mind, and spirit. You do not play as an imaginary character. You play as yourself in a way you never played before. There are no zombies, orcs, or vampires.
It sounds like this isn't even a role-playing game.
There are no magic spells, sorcery. But emotions will skyrocket. During gameplay, you will meet many characters who seem familiar, like you've met them before.
This person's just trying to kickstart this. Like, I went to a Catholic school, and one time we had a teacher's assistant do like a meditative meditation exercise with us that was like Christian themed, and like there's a whole thing where they basically, like, you know, we had to meditate while they led us through this little narrative where Jesus was interacting with us, and we had to imagine our parts of it, and this just sounds like somebody's selling that on Kickstarter.
You missed this key part though. Okay. During gameplay, you will meet many characters who seem kind of familiar, like you've met them before, but then you will realize, Tom, they're from the Bible.
Ah, that's cool. I like that. The real trick with that guided meditation thing was there's a part where Jesus gives you something and you have to decide what it is, and Jesus gave me a dagger. I thought that was pretty kick-ass. But,
hell yeah, that's... That's like Benedetta Jesus.
It's like fucking... it's like Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You know, Santa comes and gives you magic items.
Well, that's true, including a sword. Oh, man. I gotta save this for a tavern pick sometime, because reading further into it, like, they want you to... They weren't kidding about it being a physical RPG. Like, for example, here's a team challenge. The team is supposed to pick up a bitten companion and keep them above ground for a minimum of 60 seconds. The bitten person has to lie down on the floor completely limp. The other team members must pick them up and hold them for 60 seconds. The GM keeps track of time. Also note, they're using GM. GM is the title for this one.
Man, what if the GM is actually God and... when they say the GM's keeping track of time, it's just like
God is keeping track of time.
Just hold your friend and you'll know.
So if you cool, all right. So if they fail, you cannot carry the sick companion. One of you goes back to the village and has to come back with help. Together you transfer the sick companion back to the village, and the whole operation takes 2 days. But if you succeed, you may continue and carry the companion. But it is exhausting, and your pace will be slower.
And when they say exhausting, they mean physically exhausting, because you're going to
have to hold up your friend. What if your friend is like me, you know, a great big fat ass? Doesn't seem fair.
I haven't seen you in a while. I didn't think that you were that fat, McGill. But nah, I mean,
I'm not that fat. I got a belly though. I'm not afraid to admit that I'm a chonky dude.
I feel like you would.
I got like dad bod. That's what I got.
Well, there was a recent thing recently. Damn it. Where the McElroy brothers, Justin McElroy was telling a story and he said he described himself as a husky boy. And then Travis later in like commenting on the story used the term husky boy. And he was like, no, I get to call myself a husky boy. But I feel like, you know, maybe like you just said chonky. I feel like husky boy. Dad bod, I don't know. It's all.
There's actually a way better way to describe it, and I've used this phrase to describe myself. You know it, Tom.
Is it the panda bear figure?
I maintain a consistent panda bear shape.
Man, fantastic. Back to Talking Heads. True Stories, something we've mentioned before, but a great little musical movie. That's a lot of fun and very bizarre. We still haven't even mentioned what I got this time, is I got Operation Honor Curse. Like, that's
Honor
supposed
Curse?
To mean
that
something.
Sounds like something from The Road to Bethlehem.
Oh, man. Yeah, like, man, I just feel like, okay, so here's my biblical role-playing game thing, is that one time, you know, it's like, old Vampire the Masquerade was all very, like, pseudo-biblical. It's like, oh, all the vampires come from Cain, the first murderer, and all that. And I don't like having to learn all that shit. That's one of the reasons I like Requiem, is you can just sort of make up your own backstory every time. But with Masquerade, there's all these, like, big biblical undertones and stuff, and thematic motifs and etc. And even I didn't do this in a Masquerade game, I did it in a Requiem game, but it would have really fit in a Masquerade game, is I had a sort of magic item, artifact, a weapon that was called the Pharaoh's Bane. Do you know what it was, McGill?
The Pharaoh's Bane?
Yeah.
Was it some kind of a rod?
Oh, you're close. Do you give me some more? Give me some more.
Is it a rod that turns into a snake?
Hell yes!
Yeah!
Yeah! Cool ass part. There's a staff that you throw it down and it turns into this like supernaturally venomous snake.
That's wicked. That's a good one.
Pharaoh's Bane.
Man, you know, like, I am not a religious dude, and I kind of feel like the more modern interpretations of the Bible are kind of dull. But there's some awesome mythology in there if you dig for it. Like, you ever see that Darren Aronofsky movie Noah?
No, but didn't he add, like, stone giants to that or something?
Well, the stone giants are the Nephilim.
Oh.
They're like, fallen angels who have these weird sort of rock-like forms and extra appendages.
I mean, yeah, I don't know.
That movie's nuts.
Yeah, I don't know that one so well. I know his other Bible one, The Mother.
Yeah, that one's not as good.
That one's goofus doofus.
But I mean, rod that turns into a snake. That's some classic D&D stuff right there.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Put it in your game, whatever you feel like. So Honor Curse, yeah, I don't know. Honor Curse is like, I mean, it's a good operation, but I feel like I can't really say much about it without getting into it. I feel like I might be spoiling it or something. We just came off a good one where they had to help run it in for 10 days.
Yeah, I really liked that setup.
And, so do we want to just like roll right into mine?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So basically, that last one happened in the Frowning Jester Inn at Snakebite Springs outside Port Ravendusk. But with that job done, the players and their caravan can roll into Port Ravendusk and, you know, take some time, enjoy the benefits of being in a major city, you know? They're going to have to hit the road again fairly, like, relatively soon. They don't have, like, unlimited downtime here. But it's the sort of thing where it's like, oh, cool, we've been on the road for a while, we've been in this caravan dealing with random events, etc. And now we can just, like, pop into a city and enjoy all the benefits that that entails. So, while they're in the city, there are a few people that leave the caravan because getting to the city was effectively their goal in traveling with the caravan. So I had mentioned previously, speaking of that word prodigy, the tiefling prodigy Rin, who's a young tiefling that the caravan picked up at one of the academies that they stopped at, she had shown that she was like at a level of skill and knowledge that basically there wasn't anything else for the academy to teach her. So she agreed to go with the caravan in the hopes that they could take her to like a major civilized area, and then she'd find some sort of like either more appropriate education or like a higher calling. And so the way that manifests is that she stops and heads for the clinic in Port Ravendusk. So she's going to go on to become sort of a medical, kind of a biology specialist, I guess. Specializing in things that live and how things stay living, medicals and biology and stuff. She's a prodigy. She's
almost
smart.
like a zoologist of some kind.
Not so much that. More just like, I don't know. Like, I tend to think of like Bones or Beverly Crusher. You know, they're the doctor, but they're also the person who knows all the science about like living things, right?
Ah, yeah. Okay.
Also, when she leaves, I had mentioned this before. When I had mentioned companions leaving the caravan for the city. But her reward for the party when she leaves is the benefit of shadow steeds, which are basically these sort of illusory or magical steeds, which I got the idea from Warhammer Fantasy. They appear in Vermintide, as there's like in the illusory school of magic. I think it's gray magic. You can conjure up these shadow steeds. And so like in Vermintide, in the first game, whenever you're leaving a mission, the way you get away is like in a wagon driven by shadow steeds that are able to just like, you know, wait however long they need to get you out of there. But the advantage that it poses for the caravan is that these shadow steeds don't need to be fed or anything. They get a certain number of steeds to drive the wagons that they don't have to worry about taking care of. Which, considering that the steeds get sick, they need to be fed and watered and everything, it's a good thing to take a little weight off their shoulders. Al-Samisath also departed the caravan, although he also so he showed them when he left, like he invited them to this manor that he had in Port Ravendusk, but then he also showed them, you know, the thing I was kind of thinking of with this part, do you remember, I think it's in Peaky Blinders season 4, is Tommy Shelby starts like a gin company, or he starts making gin like in his basement or something. The reason I bring this up is that this is the way that I kind of imagine Al-Samisath introducing his sort of crimson refinery to the players, which basically he reveals that he's been doing his own sort of like alchemical experiments. And so in the basement of his manor, he has been experimenting with that fluid from the last campaign, the crimson. And he has basically used the crimson to create a more effective health potion formula. And so there's this sort of cutscene where they like visit Al-Samisath in his manor and he shows them around and he's like, hey, by the way, I've been working on something. But with this improved health potion formula, which he shares with not only the players, but with the entire MPOC, so that they're overall, like, when they buy stuff from the MPOC, they'll get these better health potions. All it is like, you know that you roll a health potion, you drink a health potion in 5e, it's like you roll 2d4 plus 2.
Yeah, and then that scales based on whether it's normal or greater or superior, right?
Yeah, so basically Al-Samasath then cracked the formula that makes it maximize every time. So from now on, Empok's got a new and improved health potion formula, and it's better, and heals you up better. But I'll tell you something, there's a little catch to this, is because we know, you and I know, the benefit of being in the time we are now. You know, back at the back when this happened, I was keeping it on the down low, I had hidden, but Al-Samasath, he's a dang old minister. He's got a ministry parasite in him. So it was one of the things that when it was revealed that he is a minister, is it's like, well then, did the ministry have something to do with this new health potion formula? Is there something about the health potion formula other than the new effects that we don't know? Or is it that the ministry wants us to have better health potions for some reason? Like, do they have a larger goal here? What's going on? So it's something
sounds
that looking back...
sinister.
Yeah, it's like one of these things that looking back, like at the time it was just like, oh sweet, we got new health potions and now they heal us better and we don't have to worry about rolling or anything. But looking back from our now position with the benefit of hindsight, it's like, but something else is going on here. How did Al-Samasath come up with these crazy, you know, new health potion formula? Another person departing the caravan was Kalkin. Kalkin, we remember from Al's Aces. He was the dwarven guard captain who believed the framing setup job that Al's Aces were set up for the murder of Ambassador Garlander. Good friend of the Empok, but Kalkin thought that the Empok had turned on him and so believed that Al's Aces had assassinated him and so hounded them all over the dwarven city of Arten until they were able to clear their names. And once they did so, Kalkin had to eat crow, which is a funny expression to use in this circumstance because the real assassin was a Kenku. But the point is, Kalkin had to eat crow and accept that he led the dwarven guards all on a dangest wild goose chase after these players that were innocent, and he felt so bad afterwards that as a kind of penance he joined the Empok as an Empok agent. And so the caravan picked him up when they were rescuing Foob and Odium from that subterranean Nightside Eclipse cult base. He joined the caravan and it was just a thing of like, well, the nearest city is Port Ravendusk and that's where I gotta go. So I'll tag along with you guys until we get there. And then, another benefit of being in Port Ravendusk is that Mephili can check in with her sort of half brother dragon turtle Atuin, they haven't seen each other since this caravan trip began, because it's been a very land-based caravan trip. But now here in the city of Port Ravendusk, she can just head on over to the docks and catch up with how he's been and everything.
Hey, what a nice reunion.
Yeah, and Atuin's been on his own sort of adventures around the coast and stuff, getting to know some of the local aquatic life and whatnot. And basically, like, I have sort of, like, while they are on the caravan, I know, or I have ideas of what Atuin is getting up to. And so basically, I think initially at this point, all I really establish is that, like, Atuin is going around and sort of, like, talking to other major aquatic creatures, like maybe whales or something, and just sort of, like, getting to know the local aquatic life as a dragon turtle would. But it is important to keep in mind that Atuin is hatched from an egg that was one of three eggs retrieved from the nest of two like corrupted, sort of necrotized dragon turtles that were in, like, they were living in under the city of Decima, so like within Drail. So basically, the thing to keep in mind is that Atuin is like, he is from Drail in a sense, basically. Like, he may be from Thress, but his family is from Drail. So the thing is that eventually what I had planned and what I eventually revealed through Atuin is I had Atuin make contact with his grandfather, who was an ancient dragon turtle who lives off the coast of Drail in the deep waters. And they are going to, he's going to have a sort of like family connection that way and rediscover his heritage. And the father of Atuin, I named Woe Fat. You know where that's from?
Woe Fat.
W-O-F-A-T.
That sounds very familiar. It's not Big Trouble in Little China.
No.
Ah, oh, man. Woe Fat. Is that Warrior?
No.
No? No, I don't know. Where is it from, Tom?
I believe it is the recurring villain to Hawaii Five-0.
I never would have gotten that. It's been forever since I saw any Hawaii Five-0.
It's also the name of a great, doom stoner metal band, Woe Fat, and that was part of the inspiration as well. Going back to the metal, as always. But basically, that was sort of a thing. It's like, just like I've been seeding the whole thing about Mephili discovering her forgotten memories. At the same time, it's like, if Atuin is doing stuff out of the picture, I have an idea of what he's doing. And eventually, the narrative I have planned is that he reconnects with his grandfather, having been sort of disconnected from him by like a generation because of the corruption of his parents. But again, yeah, rediscovering his heritage, his dragon turtle heritage, where he comes from. Another thing about being in Port Ravendusk is not only do people leave the caravan, but of course there's people in the city who are interested in joining the caravan. And so the first of those is Professor Nesne and Rob Fling, which is another callback to their adventures when they were dealing with Kalkin and the Kenku assassin in Arden, the Dwarven City. Do you remember Professor Nesne and Rob Fling?
I remember the name. I don't remember the context in which he was used.
He's a Dwarven inventor that was working on flying machines.
That's right.
And they ended up recruiting him. Initially, he is targeted for assassination by the Kenku assassins in that city adventure, but then they rescued him, and he helped them escape using a ramshackle flying machine, escape from a raid from the Dwarven law enforcement. And then, afterwards, he went on to become sort of the Empok's like aviator, their sort of aircraft expert. And so now he's with the Empok, and he's the guy who designs their aircraft that they use in battle. They used his Black Sabbath fighter aircraft design in the invasion of the Deathlands, in which Port Ravendusk was liberated. So anyways, now he is a major Empok figure, sort of this aviation engineer. And he joins the caravan here at Port Ravendusk. They also, speaking of the liberation of Port Ravendusk, may remember that when Port Ravendusk was liberated, there was a major naval assault that the Draelic army launched, where they used They used the Slayer battleship, and the Slayer battleship is still docked in the sort of harbor of Port Ravendusk. You can still, like, when they visit the city, the Slayer battleship is still in the bay. And so while they're in the city, another one of the stops that they visit is they go and visit the deck of the Slayer battleship, where they meet Magnus and Alistair, two of Empok's finest. Magnus being Magnus Dwarf Belly, now a goblin after he was reincarnated in the last session of that first campaign, and Alistair being our friend, Alistair Infernus, the Infernal Warlock, who is loyal to Mephisto ever since that campaign. So two people from the original MPOX, you know, player group are joining the caravan here, and they meet up with the party on the deck of the Slayer battleship. Also, while the players are on the Slayer battleship, they have access to the armory, which is provided by way of the Slayer battleship. So that's all the stuff that happens while they are enjoying their downtime in Port Ravendusk. As they, you know, people leave the caravan, people join the caravan, they get to reconnect with Atuin, they get to spend some time with all these different NPCs. And then it's back on the road, as I said, and this time they're headed from Snakebite Springs to Butchertown, a little town of Butchertown. Named from a song by the band Hammers of Misfortune that I'm a fan of.
Can't say I'm familiar with them.
Well, there's a line. Oh, Hammers of Misfortune is great. And they got a line in that song. Everything is metal now. Metal is the king whose crown is melted down in Butchertown. I don't know. One of them is everything is metal now. Metal is the king whose crown is melted down, and everything is concrete now. Concrete is the queen whose kingdom crumbles down. Or it might be the king and queen reversed. I can't remember. But it all happened in Butchertown, and those are all lyrics. That's a great song. Snakebite Springs to Butchertown. There's a random event. One of the horses goes missing. Another reason why it's good to have Shadow Steed. You control them, they don't wander off when you let them loose to graze or anything. These Deathlands, it's hard to keep track. The players had all sorts of livestock with their caravan and whatnot, so it's hard to keep track of it all. And Dangus, they're keeping track of their caravan, traveling, and then one of the horses goes missing. Dangus Mangus. Honestly, I don't know if the horse went missing and they never found it, or if the horse went missing and they just, you know, took extra time and lost extra supplies, you know, spending the extra time to go and find it. I'm actually not sure how that shook out, but that's random events for you. You don't plan them out that way, and they just sort of happen. They come to the farmsteads outside Butchertown, and one of the farmsteads is burning. They hear the cries of a civilian inside. They manage to rescue Farmer Kip, who's stuck in the ruins of the farm. But he begs them to help because there's wagon and boot tracks still. These bloody panda bugbear raiders attacked his farmstead, burnt his farmstead, took his wife and two of the laborers as captives. Done left him for dead in the farm. So the players,
I'm just going to let you know, Tom, that everything Farmer Kip says, even though it is not the correct name, my brain is going to hear it in the voice of Kif from Futurama.
It's funny because I was even thinking the same thing before you said it. And I was like, I thought you were going to say Kip from Futurama. And it wasn't until you said it that I was like, oh, yeah, his name's Kif. Oh, well.
Yeah.
He needs help. Oh, dear. Etc.
I need help. Farmer yes. Kip, you need assistance from Brannigan.
They took a bunch of his stuff. They burned his farm, left him for dead, took his wife and two of the laborers from his farmstead. So the players hit the trail following those wagon and boot tracks and managed to find the bloody panda bugbear convoy, the tail end of it, taking away these supplies and everything. They managed to rescue Kip's wife and the two laborers, take out these bloody panda bugbear raiders. But it's a sign. It's just the sign of further bloody panda aggression, because this was just a raiding party on one of the local farmsteads. There's word that the bloody pandas have been striking all over this area, and they're going for Butchertown next. So the players take Kip and his wife and the two laborers with them, and they head for Butchertown, where they meet some of the locals. They meet the mayor, Mo, his son, Ned, his wife, Belle, his daughter, Liv, his son, Mick, Ned's kids, Rick and Dia. They meet a local goblin named Mike. They meet a knight named Ram. And they meet a pair of dwarven brothers named Ren and Rod. And Rod is the local smith. Ren is just one of the local guards.
I have a question for you.
Is it about all these names having three letters?
Yes.
It's just easy to come up with, you know? It's
very easy to
populate a town of people.
I'm not sure if I've ever asked this on the show before, but like, how do you come up with the names for your NPCs?
I mean, for a lot of these ones, I just have, I actually had a list and I've gone through most of it, but it's a list that had, a list of three letter names. It's basically a list of three letter combinations that make names. And, so I've gone through a lot of the list. Like I had a list that I could easily reference for all these quick names for all these minor characters that, like, you know, I don't know how much
number one on the list. Tom.
No, but I used Tom for I had a goblin warlock, the one that I used in the Horde of the Dragon Queen campaign that I played. He had a mask of many faces, so he could cast disguise self at will as an invocation. And he had this secret, this like alter ego, Tom Binban, known halfling merchant. And anytime he needs like, go incognito, he claimed to be this known halfling merchant. You know, people know Tom Binban. He's a known halfling merchant. It's really
Bin
funny.
Binban with two B's or Binman, like the guy who comes and collects your trash bins.
Binban. Tom Binban, known halfling merchant. I remember there's a time one of the players at the table was like, "Are you saying gnome halfling merchant?" And I'm like, "No, he's a known halfling merchant. People know him."
Apparently, this name causes a lot of confusion because I had a question about it as well.
Should also be said that currently, the players in my ongoing campaign, which is Coyote's Ages still, the players are currently traveling with a goblin by the name of Jimjar Bonbon. And let's just say the players are awfully suspicious about this character.
But we'll get to him later.
Yeah. Hopefully not too soon. I'm still playing it. Anyways. So they meet all these characters with these easy little three-letter names. You know, a lot of them are, you know, I introduced the mayor's whole family, but like only some of them are going to be notable. I have little notes on all of them. Like his daughter Liv actually has some talent as a druid, which comes up a bit later. I have one of Ned's kids, Rick. He's secretly got a knife that he's not supposed to have, but he's got a concealed weapon if he needs one. I have the dwarven brothers, Ren and Rod. Ren is just one of the local guards. Rod is the smith I mentioned. He's like the local blacksmith. It's also a knight that has residence in the area, Ram. You know, just like a few key figures. There's also like plenty of civilians in the town that they don't meet. But I introduced like the mayor's main family and some key figures. And the reason I introduce all these people and it's important is because everybody's going to have to participate in the Battle of Butchertown. The bloody panda bugbears are coming. It's known that their raiding parties are attacking the local farmsteads, and it's only a matter of time before they come in force for the town of Butchertown. So the players, it's almost like a classic, like Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven kind of thing. Although I guess the thing is, like, in Seven Samurai, do the villagers help in Seven Samurai, or is it just the Seven Samurai do all the fighting?
I think they help, but man, that's one that I really haven't seen in forever. I have seen the Magnificent Seven far more recently.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's part of the story, right? Is training the villagers a bit?
Yeah, I honestly can't really remember either. And the
I'm gonna
is,
look
like,
it up.
The trouble is that like it's a story that's been done so many times, right? Like even A Bug's Life has the plot line where like they come to a village and the evil guy is always coming for the tithe, and they decide, no, we're not gonna pay the tithe. You know?
The answer is yes, the villagers do help out in Seven Samurai as well.
All right, so this is a perfect Seven Samurai situation. The bloody panda bugbears are coming. The players prepare fortifications, organize the locals to prepare for the attack. The bugbears, when they arrive, utilize a smoke screen. They use a dry brush and set it on fire and create a smoke screen outside the town. About 30 feet out from the town palisades. I mentioned, so it was important that I introduced the mayor's family because some of them are like proudly throwing themselves into this battle. Like Mayor Mo asks them, like, I need you to make sure that like my son Ned doesn't sacrifice himself in some sort of brave heroic. And of course he tries to because he's like the valiant firstborn son. But also I mentioned Liv is a competent druid, and so she surprises people by casting entanglement and manages to entangle the bugbears as they come out of the smoke screen. But of course that puts her in harm's way because she has to be up on the fortifications casting it. The advantage here is that even though some of the mayor's family are sort of risking their lives and taking undue risks, Connor is a cleric, and so he's able to heal and resuscitate anybody who puts themselves in harm's way and pays for it. In addition, there's a bunch of civilians that are helping out. Basically, they've got civilians going around the fortifications, dispensing ammunition, providing medical aid to people who need it. And in the end, Butchertown's casualties totaled 10. There were 2 guards, a scout, and 7 civilians that died in the fighting. But overall, the party and their allies were able to hold back the bloody panda bugbears, slay both their champion and their shaman, and they were able to hold off the bloody panda bugbears until a reinforcing party of local Amberfang gnolls arrived. That's another one of the tribes that is native to the Deathlands that I mentioned at the beginning of the campaign. So we know the bloody panda bugbears pretty well, but another one that is sort of friendly to the Draelic folk in the Deathlands is the Amberfang Knoll tribe. And so they send a party of reinforcements to the town to drive back the bloody pandas, knowing that their allies are in danger. So they come to relieve the town of Butchertown, forcing the remaining bugbears to flee. And also, another note is that when the dust settles, the players find the Crucifist Greataxe on the corpse of the Bloody Panda Champion. So they've added another Crucifist weapon to their collection. And the caravan was, of course, treated to a feast in their honor for their help in saving the town. And so no supplies were taken up by this particular rest on the journey.
Hey, that's nice.
But yeah, it was like, it's funny. I feel like we talk about battle sessions all the time. And once again, we're coming to this. But it's an interesting thing because I've ran... So I guess the thing to say is, like, in this case, the battle was very small scale, and it's something that's really nice about playing D&D at a lower level, is that to simulate this battle, all I really had to run was, like, one shaman, one bugbear champion and then like 10 bugbears. And then I could literally run on the grid map just like the players and then have the NPCs and stuff and just sort of have these general rules of like, okay, here's the role for the civilians or like the guards firing arrows at the bugbears. I mentioned I had Liv cast Entanglement. Like I had the NPCs do things that could easily be summed up with just a dice roll or provided a utility function in the case of the Entanglement spell. But then from there, the players basically have this fortified position and like taking advantage of the benefits from that, I can then just run a pretty straightforward combat between the players and these like this small group of like a dozen bloody panda bugbears. And in that small scale, like it was definitely only like one session, and yet it felt like a proper, like, you know, Seven Samurai, like defense of a town. The thing is that later in this campaign, Coyote's Aegis, I run much bigger military operations. And I think like I really managed to, like, I feel like where I'm at, I have a good sense of how to run these different types or these different scales of battle, where like this is a good example of how to run a very small thing, again, like the Seven Samurai thing where you're just defending a town. I also think of things like I'm thinking of the attack on the safe house in Gangs of London, which you recently saw. Yeah. But I also think of like the movie Zulu, which is like, I don't know. Do you know that movie?
You know, I've never seen it. I know of it, of course.
It also has sort of the vibe of like a zombie movie. Because the thing with Zulu is like you have a small group of people who have, you know, they have the technological advantage in terms of guns, but there are so many more Zulu warriors coming at them that it's kind of like, you know, you will not have the bullets to kill everyone who's coming at you. And so it's this very tense situation of like, again, they are defending like a very small area, like a town, and just like a huge tribe is coming down on them. I didn't play up like with Zulu, it's almost like a 300 Spartan sort of thing where it's like a total matter of attrition, and I didn't play up that aspect so much, but it does have that aspect of sort of like, you know, there are civilians going around and like trying to like put out fires and things like that. One of the buildings catches fire at one point. But yeah, I think like, so there's that type of battle where it's just like one encounter or skirmish or one like big defense. But then later in Coyote's Aegis, I ran battles which were like proper full-scale military operations. But the difference there is that those were like multiple sessions. There were like lots of different objectives to go around and do and handle on different places in like during the battle and on the battlefield. Like, you know, the enemy might bring a special weapon to bear in a certain area, and so the players have to go deal with that. But then also there are prisoners of war that need to be rescued, and so the players might go do that in a different area later. And so that's like a big sprawling large-scale battle. But then this is like, again, it's one of the benefits of doing a lower level game is just like, or having a game at lower levels is like, you can do something simpler that like has all that feeling of like an epic battle. But it's just like something, you're just defending a town from raiders, for example. It also brings to mind like your battle at the end of the Vernon Apocalypse. That was one where it was like, you know,
defending a fortress kind of a thing.
Yeah, it was more about holding the line than like going around and doing like a full military operation where it's like, you know, there's areas that need to be taken and whatnot. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that, like, I introduced a bunch of characters, like Liv, the druid, Ned, the knight, Ram, the goblin, Mike, Ren, and Rod. These are all characters that come back later in the campaign, and a lot of them come back as members having signed on to the Draelic military. And so, like three or four acts later, you have these scenes where basically they'll meet, like, Ned, for example, and he'll be like, yeah, I don't know if you remember me, but we fought together at the Battle of Butchertown. And they're like, oh, yeah. Like, it's funny because the players might forget these NPCs, but they fully remember the Battle of Butchertown. And so having that as a reference point is, like, it immediately... It's one of these things where, like, immediately the players like that NPC more by being like, oh, yeah, cool, that guy fought alongside us, and now he's joined the army because, like, you know, from that experience. I will also say that in the notes for this episode, I got a great little, Bayo tapestry-type side-on thing, representation of the Battle of Butchertown, and I'm just... pretty proud of that. It's fun. Got all the people, got all the defenders, got all the bugbears in there.
I gotta give you props for naming the, like, historic events that transpire in your campaigns. I never think to do that, but, like, calling it the Battle of Butchertown and then being able to refer back to it like that is smart, and it gives it that epic fantasy feeling to it, right? It's like the Battle of Helm's Deep or the Battle of the Long Night, the Battle of the Bastards. I never think to name my events in that same way.
Yeah, I feel like I'm... It's funny because you say that, but I don't even feel like I've been terribly creative in the way that I've named them. I generally just name them after the place, right? Like, we talk about the liberation of Port Ravendusk or the invasion of the Deathlands. Like, it's just what happened at a place. I didn't even give it, like, a very special name. The Battle of Butchertown is just, it was a battle at Butchertown.
You don't need a special name, like, though. Like, yeah. The just giving it a title, giving it an official name, is enough to make it sound significant. I mean, here's a funny thing to contemplate. This podcast has really seen a lot of wild historical events transpire in the background as we've recorded it. And, we've talked about the Freedom Convoy in Ottawa. Well, there were all those...
Called that the Goofus Insurgency.
The Goofus Insurgency, but there were all those protesters who stood up to the convoy in the Glebe, and they called their protest the Battle of Billings Bridge, and suddenly it just sounds so much more like, wow, yeah, fuck yeah, the Battle of Billings Bridge, hold the line, guys. Like, it does give it this air of significance, even if you're just, the battle of whatever. That wasn't even a battle, it was a counter-protest. But it does make it sound that much more epic.
One more thing I will mention before we jump over to your side of things is something I want to mention about these bloody panda bugbears that I had attacking Butchertown is I had them armed with clubs, but I had them armed, each one was carrying a bunch of clubs because they could be used as throwing clubs. You ever seen throwing clubs? Like, a lot of indigenous and African tribes use them, I find.
Yeah, they have a kind of, like, hooked shape, right? With a big ball on one end.
Yeah, there are different kinds, really. And so, yeah, there's some that use the sort of ball head. And some of them are honestly, like, some of them are just straight clubs with the ball head. They don't always have the hook. But all this to say... That it was just a very simple adjustment that I made, but I feel like gave it a lot of character, and also is something that, like, I don't know, should just be in more things. It's like, in 5e, you look at the weapons list, club's there, but there's no range for it. Like, there's no range for it the way there is for a hand axe or a light axe or what have you, or a light hammer for throwing. And you can throw a club. It's been proven historically you can throw a club. And Bloody Panda Bugbears, better believe if they raid your farmstead, they probably throw a damn stick at you.
This is just speculation on my part, but it occurs to me, has the weapons list from the player's handbook actually changed all that much over the years? Like, I kind of feel like it's probably the same weapons list, just with updated stats, since maybe 3.0?
I mean, I think even 3.0 had things on it that do not appear in the current list. I think the current list is quite streamlined and stripped down. I think in order to avoid the kind of beginner's confusion that happens when you have too many like weird types of pole arms, because that was definitely a problem in AD&D and whatnot, where you had all your different, like your hook bill and your arm and your bardition, et cetera. And all of them had different like interactions and stats and stuff. I feel like third edition had a little bit more of that in terms of like having extra weapons. I'm not sure though. I could be wrong about that. But the list now is like very stripped down, I would say, which I don't really have a problem with that.
No, me neither. It's just, it occurred to me that that weapons list probably hasn't changed all that much. Though I guess it has changed somewhat, at least since AD&D.
You know what, actually, because I'd been playing Pathfinder recently, that is like pretty directly based on third edition, right? Or 3.5. And that has like tons and tons of weapons. So third edition probably does have a much longer list than 5e.
Add that to the pile of things I gotta bring to a future tavern. I'm gonna cross-reference all of the weapon lists across D&D editions and see how much overlap there actually is.
Well, and I think I'm all done talking about Operation Honor Curse and the Battle of Butchertown, unless you've got any more questions.
No, I mean, that was a pretty straightforward session. Nice, it's like the assault on the caddy.
Hey, yeah, there's another one.
There we go. It's assault on Precinct 13. Hold the line. Defend the fortress.
Yeah, I think, actually, I was about to say, I think it's mostly Seven Samurai because of the villagers helping out. But then with the caddy, they like do have like, you know, Kurt Bunker is a civilian who helps out, really, like. They do have all the stuff where people get involved.
I mean, talking about Seven Samurai really makes me realize just how often that plot setup has been used. Army of Darkness does it.
Yeah, man. It makes me think that maybe we got to have a rescreening at Channel M.
Yeah, heck yeah. Let's just
hit us.
Screen all of the different Seven Samurai remixes.
Yeah. Including A Bug's Life. Hit us with the penultimate session of the verse.
So, as I mentioned, I had to change my plans. Not at the last minute. I got enough warning that I wasn't scrambling. But I had to change what I had planned because suddenly, Song, Cater, was not available. He wasn't going to make it to the session. And we had already scheduled it. We'd already gotten everybody together. It was just, you know, beyond his control. His work needed him. And so I decided the best way to pivot would be to poach from Firefly again. Because, you know, we're in the end game of a Firefly-inspired campaign. Players have had some time getting up close and personal with the actual content of that TV show after most of the campaign was kind of just doing its own thing, being a space western set in that universe. And it's funny, but for the penultimate session of the verse, I used the plot of the ultimate episode from Firefly, the final episode. And I can't for the life of me remember what it was called, but the plot of this episode, it was self-contained. It was not dealing with an overarching plot. And the plot of this episode is a bounty hunter infiltrates the ship Serenity and with the intent of taking everyone captive. And the episode is just this bounty hunter, who the character's name is Jubal Early. He takes out the different characters one at a time until he can, you know, gain command of the ship and presumably take them off to, you know, whoever they're turning in for the bounty, the Alliance.
It's just like Saffron did.
It is like Saffron, but this one is definitely a bit more, I don't know. I guess the difference is that this isn't an NPC or a character who, like, infiltrates using charisma. This is, like, he docks with Serenity when most of the crew is asleep, and then, like a ninja, works his way through the ship meticulously, taking out each character.
Oh, like the game Heat Signature.
Yeah, in a way
that... You ever play that?
I have played that. You recommended it to me. I played it on your recommendation.
Kick ass. This is exactly what you do in Heat Signature. You stow away via airlock, sneak in, fucking sneak around, kill everybody.
So I wanted to do the same thing. And, you know, picking an appropriate approach for each character, because each character is slightly different. And this also allowed me to have a bit of fun with the fact that Cater wasn't there. You'll see how I did that. So I decided to go with that plot setup, but instead of a bounty hunter, I had it be that River, the character from the crew of Serenity, the living weapon, she stowed away on the Tong ship that the players stole. So we start off, and I just did random rolls to determine who is on guard detail and who was piloting, and then everybody else is asleep at the start of the adventure. They're in their bunks, not their bunks, they're just in the bunks of the stolen Tong ship, and they're all completely exhausted from their recent escapades. They're still a ways out from Verbena, where they're heading to try and hide out, scrub their identities again and disappear into the crowds. And the Tong ship that they stole is a real clunker. I can't remember who I had on pilot duty, but I was making them roll, you know, knowledge technology to figure out what they know about the ship. They find out it's an Adelaide-class livestock transport that's been discontinued for about a decade, ever since regulations about the amount of livestock that can be shipped interplanetarily were put in place. So it's this big, clunky ship made for hauling huge amounts of livestock, which means it has a lot of storage space for people like River to hide. And even at full speed ahead, it barely reaches half the top speed of the kennel. So it's frustratingly slow. What the players don't realize. So I've got I can't remember who is on pilot duty, but Chow is on guard duty, and he's just patrolling the ship, making sure everything is okay. And what nobody realized is that there are still two Tong soldiers on the ship that they hid immediately when the ship got stolen. So Chow is just doing sort of a patrol of the ship. He's in the cargo bay, and he finds a big sack of cow feed that's been split open all over the floor. He's like, that's weird. And he goes and he investigates it, and reaching into it, he pulls out a gun, and he realizes that all these bags of cow feed are smuggling weapons. But he only has a brief moment to realize this when suddenly two Tong soldiers, you know, jump out of hiding and ambush him. They got guns on him. And they're saying, like, you know, make a move, make a sound, you're dead. Hands in the air, you know, stand up, drop the gun, turn around to face the other way. So Chow, you know, slowly gets to his feet and he's trying to think of what to do to subdue these guys. When suddenly he hears like the, you know, pow, pow, poof, poof, sounds of punches and combat behind him. And when he turns around, there's River and she's taken out these two Tong guys and now she's got a gun on Chow. And immediately, you know, Steve, who was playing Chow, he's like, oh, no, I'm going up against River. This is bad. But combat ensues, and she has psychic abilities, like psionic abilities, and one of them is like a psionic daze ability. So I allowed them to do some hand-to-hand combat, and then she, like, dazes him and knocks him out. And it's always fun, I know I've talked about this before, but it's always fun playing around with the discrepancy between what characters know and what players know. Like, I know I've mentioned it before in the context of the verse where players will recognize like a character from the TV show Serenity, but of course their characters don't know that. And it's fun sort of watching them role play it and have to grapple with the difference in what they know versus what their characters know. And this was another case where it was really fun to watch their reactions because, of course, none of their characters really know what's going on. But, you know, Chow's just been knocked out by River. Oh, my God. What does that mean? What does that mean for the rest of us? What is going to happen? So, River then begins subduing each of the party. And I had an order that she would go after them written down. And the reason I said that this allowed me to have fun with the fact that Cater wasn't around is because I did with Song what happens to Jane on that episode of Firefly, which is he is just completely passed out. And so River, like, finds Song's bunk, and she looks inside, and he is just sound asleep, snoring loudly, and she locks him in his bunk. And that gets Song out of the way, and, you know, don't have to worry about the fact that Cater isn't there. Gale, she finds Gale, and he's in his bunk, probably drinking. I can't remember exactly what Seth was having Gale doing, but she sort of pops in the doorway, and Gale is immediately confused by who this woman is on board. And, you know, River is a beautiful woman. Summer Glau is a beautiful-looking woman. And so immediately he was like, you know, because he's the brash character, he's like, hey there, good-looking. Are you lost? And River sort of plays up the innocent, like, confused, sort of naive persona. And then as soon as Gale gets close enough, I do another little burst of hand-to-hand combat as she attacks him, and the two of them sort of come to fisticuffs, but once again, she subdues him. That's sort of a key to dealing with River. I was using stats. Yeah. I was using stats that someone had adapted to a D20 system from the Firefly RPG, and of course, she's just like this master fighter. She has some psionic abilities, and really the only way that a party could effectively take her on would be if they combine forces. And here she is going like one at a time, one-on-one, which makes it all the more difficult. For Minerva, she has to get a little more creative. Rather than just fighting Minerva, she reads Minerva's mind to find her vulnerabilities and just goes for her weak points, especially Allegro talking about, you know, you don't want to leave your dog without an owner, do you? Well, in that case, you should probably just sit down right now. And she locks Minerva in the bunk as well. And finally, Caesar, she just like outright threatens because she's just a more imposed. Caesar's a very small character, like in terms of physicality. And so she just uses intimidate to threaten Caesar to put the ship on autopilot, slow it way down, and River slowly gathers everybody together in the cargo bay, rounding them up. And the other thing about River is, of course, she's quite unhinged. So the longer that this adventure goes on, the more unhinged River becomes, and she's clearly having like a hard time maintaining her composure. And once she has them all rounded up, she just starts, you know, talking to her brother Simon, who isn't there, talking in the sort of like riddles and gibberish that River always talks in, and waving her gun around wildly. And at various points, like Danil and Chow waking up, they both try to like make a move, and she wheels around and puts the gun on them, ranting. And eventually River like points her gun directly at Danil and says, "You all see darkness, but it's because you're the ones who turn out the lights." And then as she says that, suddenly the lights go out on the ship. Red proximity lights flash on. A ship is docking with them. And everybody's like, "What is going on? You know, is it the Tongs? Who is it?" And they can hear the clunk clunk of a ship closing in, docking with the back end of the Tong ship. There's a hiss of the airlock. The cargo bay doors open. And then, of course, on step, the crew of Serenity again. They've caught up with our heroes once more. They have our heroes at their mercy. Dun dun dun. And that's it. Like, this was a really short one. Just like lots of little one-on-one encounters, playing around with that same plot formula from the it's called Objects in Space is the name of that.
It's interesting to me though that you accomplish something narratively with the end of this, where you have set it up so that they are back in the hands of the Serenity crew. And I mean, unless, assuming that this is where you intended them to be for the final session, which you didn't know that this would not be, then you would have still had to set that up, right?
Yeah, and I can, I'll tell you a little bit here about some of the stuff that's going to happen in the final session. I won't talk about all of it, but I wanted Serenity to catch up with them again. My initial plan was to have Serenity catch up with them once they've arrived on Verbena. And because, you know, it's a Firefly-inspired campaign, I didn't want Serenity to be antagonists the whole way through, because that's sort of the position they're in now. Like, the crew of Serenity are the bad guys at this point. They're trying to capture the heroes and turn them in for the bounty. But I didn't want to end on that note, because that's just not as fun. You know, all my players love these characters from the TV show. So how could I do it to them, have them be at odds the whole time? So my plan all along was for them to team up with the crew of Serenity, combine forces, because the crew of Serenity hate the Alliance as well. It was always my plan to be this big showdown where initially it's our heroes against Serenity, but also against the Alliance, and then have that flip. So it's our heroes and Serenity versus the Alliance, which is a much more fair fight, and also just gives the players the opportunity to work with these characters who they like and be on the same side. So it was always my plan to get them back to that point, but this way I got to kind of let the players replay through one of the iconic episodes of the show, and as I said, my personal favorite episode, and still get to the point where they're at odds with Serenity. They're still going to wind up in the same place, just slightly different, just slightly retooled.
All right.
And it all worked out. Hey, Tom, here's a related question to that. If a player of yours can't make it, do you just call it off? Do you call off the sesh?
So I was thinking about this because I think it depends on the session. I think, you know, talking about planning to run the last session and you end up running the second last session instead, I don't think I would. I feel like if I knew I was going into the last session, I would just call it off. In the past, we've talked about sessions. I've talked about sessions where I have had people missing, and I've also talked about sessions where people were missing and then the party got wiped out, and I was like, well, I guess we'll try again with the person actually there, because right, that's not really fair. Like, it's one of these things of, like, I think sometimes I want to play the game, and so I go through with it anyways with someone missing, but then it goes badly, and then I'm like, oh, I should have been more patient and just waited for them to be ready. And so, I think most of the time, especially now, I think most of the time I would just call it off, but that's because I have a very small group. It's like, if one person can't make it, that's a third or half the group.
And, you know, now that I'm playing a lot more online on Roll20, I more frequently am comfortable in just saying, okay, well, let's just wait and play when everybody's available, because it's less of it's not less of a commitment, but it's not like people have to, like, drive to my place, right? Because that was the thing with the playgroup from the Verse, and it really did only become sort of harder to play with these people as time went on, because, you know, Seth, he's got a kid, and everybody's got jobs, and Steve was going to go on posting again soon. So just getting everybody together and finding a time that works for everyone was enough of a challenge that I didn't want to, like, waste that. We've got everybody together. Everybody wants to play. You know, suddenly someone can't make it. Let's do it anyway. I can throw something together that allows us to play and have fun and not have to worry about it, because we've already scheduled it. We've already, you know, people have... Seth has made sure his wife can take his kid for the night and it's not a problem and all of that stuff. So it really was just like, after all of the hassle of finding a time that works for everyone, I'd hate to see that go to waste. Of course, I could have also just been like, let's play Fiasco instead or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's also a thing of like, yeah, I think I played with people missing more often when it was in person, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a good point.
And I do think, you know, I said, like, we could just play Fiasco instead. I do think that that's a pretty elegant solution. Like, our buddy Grant, I've talked to him about his campaign. He runs a campaign. And he said, like, you know, sometimes if a player's not there, we play, 10,000 years under the sun? How many years under the sun?
Oh, yeah. 1,000 years under the sun.
Yeah, he's like, we'll just play that instead. Or we'll play something like Fiasco. One of those pickup and play RPGs.
Try and get into Grant's fucking game.
he listens to the show and has asked me for RPG advice quite a bit. And
is he all up to date? I wonder.
I don't know if he's all up to date, but hopefully he is. What did he ask me about? And we got this extra time because my session was so short. I guess I can talk about this a bit. He asked me about how to reconcile different types of players in the same party.
We talked about this.
Yeah, that's right.
You brought it up in the tavern.
That's right, yeah. You know, the players who really want to fight versus the players who really want to role play character moments. How do you reconcile those? And that was a really fun conversation with him. Just sort of finding that balance. And to reiterate, my advice was just give each player something that is tailored to their character to do. So the guy who really likes combat, he's got to fight off an onslaught of zombies while the player who really likes character interactions has to negotiate with someone who doesn't want to leave the secret lab. Something like that.
Tavern time! It's tavern time!
It is tavern time. Not on this tavern, The Road to Bethlehem. Also not on this tavern, comparing the D&D manual player's handbook weapon lists. But saving those for the future.
So what do you got for us, McGill?
I have two homebrew goofy monsters.
Okay.
These have been templated out. You can find them online. We'll put them on the WordPress. And I just think they are both really funny. And here, I'll send you links to these so that you can read along. So first up, we have animated armor, but it's full of bees. Animated armor is full of bees. As the write-up here says, yep, that's the joke. What began as a completely funny, totally hilarious, not at all stupid joke from a young mage is now a staple of woods-dwelling wizards everywhere. These constructs are quite simple in design, animated armor with a beehive bonded to them. The bees receive a mobile fortress, and the armor is sustained by the latent magic in the honey. It is a relationship which empowers both and makes them far more effective guards for forest dungeons. The only immediate downside is the bears this roaming hive tends to attract. The bees do not control the armor. The armor is their home. They will defend it with everything they have. Over time, bits of leaking honey will smear over the metal, resulting in collections of dirt and greenery. This creates a natural camouflage and helps to ensure the armor is unnoticed and left alone. Given enough time, the will placed on the armor from its creator will dissipate, and the will of the queen bee will become the dominant force. Once this happens, the armor will usually be compelled to find a field of flowers to guard, and woe be to any creatures who disturb this meadow. Some of the abilities here. The creature is incapacitated while in the area of an anti-magic field. If targeted by dispel magic, the creature must make a constitution saving throw against the caster's spell DC or fall unconscious for a minute. The armor is full of a swarm of bees. When the animated armor is grappled, incapacitated, or unconscious, the bees will attack using the swarm of insects stat block. If the condition ends, they will return inside the armor and begin to regain 1d8 hit points at the start of each of the armor's turns. The bees will also attempt to bolster the armor's defense if inside it. At the start of the armor's turn, it gains 1d8 temporary HP if it does not already have any temporary HP. The buzzing from inside the armor is loud and mind-numbing. Any creatures within 15 feet of the animated armor must make a wisdom saving throw DC 12 or make their attacks against the armor with disadvantage. And as mentioned before, if the creature remains motionless and the bees are docile, it is indistinguishable from a normal suit of armor, and also the greenery and dirt on it help it camouflage in a forest setting. It's a silly thing, but I've included...
It also has a unique... This animated armor has a ranged attack.
It does.
You see? It has bee missile.
Bee missile. I guess you fire some bees, right? They don't have an elaborate description, so I'm guessing that the armor just sort of holds out an arm and bees fly at the target. 3d6 poison damage. Ouch, man. I've used animated armor full of bees in games before, and it's just a lot of fun. It's got some great flavor. It's always fun when the players think they're just going up against some animated armor.
Did you use it because you'd seen this, or had you thought of the idea before?
I used it because I'd seen this. This was something that I found like years ago, and then saved it into my like assorted D&D inspiration folder, and I bust it from time to time because I think it's really fun. But it's always a great surprise when the players go to attack the armor and suddenly they hear like a humming and a whole bunch of bees swarm out of the top of it and attack them.
Yeah, I don't like that. That's one monster this goblin doesn't want to hit with an axe.
Yeah, challenge rating 3. It's not bad. It's a pretty fun one. And credit where credit is due. This was created by a user called Snickle Socks. And then
classic Snickle Socks joint.
Yeah. So as it mentions, you know, the bees and their honey, they can become targeted. They can attract the attention of bears. But what they really wouldn't want to attract the attention of is the undead shark and bear. This is it's a zombie bear with sharks for arms. This was created by someone who calls himself Valdir, and it has no write-up. It just has the stat block. It has some great art. I guess the sharks are also undead. They look undead in this.
It really reminds me of in the Tome of Beasts that Kobold Press put out. They have a shark jaw skeleton. It's basically a skeleton made entirely out of shark's jaws.
Cool. Oh, so many teeth. The undead shark and bear is amphibious. It can breathe air and in water. In the water, the shark and bear knows the distance and direction of any enemy that doesn't have all of its hit points within 1 mile of it, residing in the same body of water. Wow, you just sent me the shark jaw skeleton. That thing is crazy. You don't want to grapple that. Boy.
Yeah, man. It's got all sorts of teeth.
Wonder what happened to the rest of the shark skeletons.
I think it says that it was, like, put together by some crazy wizard or something.
He's a fisherman wizard. Kind of wizard that lives in a lighthouse.
Oh, Sahagwin priests animate them to guard their sepulchres of bones.
Neat. So the shark and bear can sense blood in the water, and when it gets close enough, it goes into a blood frenzy. It has advantage on melee attack rolls against any creature that doesn't have all its hit points. The shark and bear has advantage on perception checks that rely on sight or smell because of its keen sight and smell, and it is undead, so if damage reduces the shark and bear to 0 points, 0 HP, it must make a constitution saving throw with a DC of 5 plus the damage taken, unless the damage is radiant or from a critical hit. On a success, the undead shark and bear drops to 1 hit point instead. It is tough to kill. And it's got a bite attack, but of course the showstopper is the shark fist attack. Plus 7 to hit, reach of 10 feet, and it does 2d10 plus 5 damage, I guess because it's a shark. It's funny, you know, like I'm looking at this, it says multi-attack, it makes 3 melee attacks, one with its bite, 2 with its shark fists, but I kind of feel like the shark fist should also get bite attacks.
Yeah, I was thinking that exact same thing.
It's like, shouldn't, or you know, if you don't want to do a separate attack for the shark fist, for the shark fist bite rather, it should be like, it's plus 7 to hit, reach of 10 feet, 2d10 plus 5 damage on a hit, and the target is then grappled because the shark latches on. Something like that.
Yeah, I also feel like there should be a special thing on the shark jaw skeleton where if you... I don't know if... Because there are abilities like Flaming Body where if you hit like a salamander or something in close combat, then you take fire damage, you know? I feel like shark jaw skeleton should have a piercing damage version of that. Like if you get too close, then you get bit.
But, yeah, I'm looking at it.
I don't know.
I'm taking a closer look at the shark jaw skeleton here, and you're right. It should really be like there should be some ability here that says like if you attempt to grapple the shark jaw skeleton,
like,
you take X damage.
It can grapple you.
Yeah,
it can grapple you and bite you. But yeah, I feel like it should be able to do some sort of passive.
Exactly. Like if you come into contact with that thing, you should take damage because look at it. So many teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a bunch of curved bones with teeth on the insides.
So, that's the animated armor full of bees. And, perhaps one of the animated armor full of bees' natural predators, the undead shark and bear. It wants your honey.
Perhaps a natural product of the remains of the shark and bear.
is the shark jaw skeleton.
The shark jaw skeleton. I think that's good for today's episode. So if you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. Or you can see our supplemental materials, our show notes, my little doodles of all the Battle of Butchertown and everything. You can find that on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. I don't think there's anything else that I have to say. So who's got something else to say? Not me.
Level up, get that ding, and the end of the verse is coming up.
Yeah, I'm excited. We'll see you next time.